Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @RightStream and #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Good afternoon from the Florida Space Coast, everyone. This is Daria Ann. I am your Right Stream Tuesday host. Also an independent author, blogger, social media specialist, and founder of the Right Stream Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio. You can find out more about Right Stream Radio by visiting our website at rightstreamradio.com. We have several amazing, excellent hosts and shows currently airing. We broadcast 5 out of 7 days a week right now, when we have shows including Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Military Monday with John D. Gresham, Right Stream Tuesday, of course, with yours truly, Family Power Hour, which is a really fun, informative family show hosted by a licensed clinical psychologist and a family law attorney. That airs on Wednesday nights. And then on Friday evenings, Lisa Tarvis and I co-host a fun women's lifestyle show called Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss. So find out all about us, again, at rightstreamradio.com. If you're interested and you want to know a little bit more about me, you can visit my website, which is dariadigiovanni.com, where you'll find that my first novel, Water Signs, A Story of Love and Renewal, my fictional, loosely autobiographical fictional drama, is on sale for $2.99 on Kindle. And I was so excited yesterday because it was a Monday and I had insomnia the night before and I was kind of slogging through my day. And then all of a sudden I got this notice of a new book review that was posted on Amazon, and it was another 5-star written by author Daniela Bova, who, by the way, is going to be a guest on this program in a couple of weeks. And, boy, I have to tell you, that just made my whole day. It was just it was really feeling like a Monday, and that was just a pick-me-up that I needed. But anyway, you can find out more about me there. Again, it's dariadigiovanni.com. And, yes, I still am working on the sequel 4 years later. But in my defense, I did ghostwrite 2 books in between over the last couple of years. And speaking of that, I'm really excited about today's show. You know, as much as I do love fiction, I find that there's nothing as inspiring as real life, and especially people who have overcome tremendous obstacles and tragedy in their lives and emerged, you know, from it even stronger and, you know, emerged as an inspiration for other people. You know, not only did they go through a tragedy and rise above it, but they dedicate their life to helping others to do the same. And that's one of the many reasons why I'm so thrilled that my guest today is author Bill Ramsey. And I do want to talk about a little bit about ghostwriting with Bill as well, because or at least collaborating with a book, because that is what he does. It's one of his specialties. And I'm going to read a little bit about his bio, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit about the book and the individual that we're going to be talking about today. If you're interested in learning more about Bill after the show, you can check out his blog. It's billramseyblog.wordpress.com, and that's Bill, RamseyBlog.wordpress.com. During his 40-year professional career, Bill Ramsey wrote technical manuals, magazine articles, and business newsletters. Retired and living in the mountains of western North Carolina, he now focuses his writing on real-life topics. He is the author of 3 books, the most recent of which is Me Now, Who Next? The Inspiring Story of a Traumatic Brain Injury Recovery. You can also learn more about Bill and his writing at liferight.com. That's life with an S, right, W-R-I-T-E.com. And before I go ahead and bring Bill on the air, I just want to read the synopsis of the book. Again, it's entitled Me Now, Who Next? The Inspiring Story of a Traumatic Brain Injury Recovery. The true and inspiring story of recovery from a severe traumatic brain injury. Young executive Angela Lee Tucker had not expected death that day. Then the unthinkable happened. A truck car crash killed her husband and left her hanging on to life by a slender golden thread. At 30, with her brain severely damaged and the critical C1 and C2 vertebrae, shoulder, and ribs badly broken, she had lost almost everything. She could have quit, but never did. Her recovery team, honored by name, included family, friends, doctors, and therapists. Today, she lives independently in New York City and is an advocate for others who have suffered brain injuries. And, you know, I didn't tell Bill this before we went live on the air. It's kind of ironic because my client, Shlomo Atiyah, also suffered a traumatic brain injury and had this miraculous recovery back in 2003. So today is going to be a really fun show. So I'm just really looking forward to it. Before I go ahead and bring Bill on the air, I want to let you know that if you have questions as the interview moves along, we welcome them at 347-945-7246. All right, and without further ado, I welcome to RightStream Tuesday author Bill Ramsey.
Hello, Daria.
Hey,
and
Bill. How are you?
I'm enjoying a lovely day down here in the mountains of western North Carolina.
Well, wonderful. Yeah, I hear that area is beautiful.
We live just south of Asheville, and it's got a great climate. I have to be careful how much I brag about it. Folks will want to move here, and we've already got plenty of people competing for space on the trails and at the waterfalls and that sort of thing.
All right. Well, Bill, let's start this out. I know I just gave the synopsis of the book, but I want to give you an opportunity to maybe fill in a little bit more about your background and experience. I mean, I know I read your bio on the blog, but introduce yourself to our listeners, and then we'll start talking about the book.
Well, first of all, I'd like to explain that I don't write fiction. I think I'm incapable of writing fiction because I find real life, which is what I write about in this book and other things that I write, so compelling and so closely approximating fiction that I don't feel I need to cross over into the fiction world. But I take great pains to, as most authors do, to write it correctly. And that's something you really can't finesse when you're writing something that's fact-checkable by the people who read your book. And there's a lot of facts out there on brain injuries, and I'd like to paint something of the size of the problem that we face as a nation with brain injuries, because I think many people don't understand how common these things are. There are, according to government statistics, 1.7 million brain injuries a year, and 52,000 of those are fatal. 300,000 people are hospitalized, and untold numbers never get recognized or reported. So the problem is actually undoubtedly larger than the 1.7 million. If you add the number three killer in the country, strokes, to this brain picture, you're looking at another 800,000 people with strokes, 130,000 of those being fatal, were one out of every 19 deaths in the United States. So it's easy to identify brain injuries and brain issues as the last frontier of medicine. I think we commonly think about cancer not being solved, but we've got a long, long way to go in understanding what we can do for those that are afflicted with brain injuries and various problems of the brain.
Now, Bill, within those statistics, within the brain injury statistics, are they, how many are caused by a traumatic event as opposed to something organic? Maybe somebody has an aneurysm or there's something.
Well,
you know, you mentioned stroke.
That would be where I would separate injuries from strokes. But there are various types of injuries, and they happen at all ages to all kinds of people, and they're not just something you'll experience because you've chosen the wrong lifestyle. You can't bring one on unless you bang your head, which is a good way to start, you know, a concussion. You can have a penetration injury if something penetrates your skull and goes into your brain. You can have oxygen deprivation, which is another type of injury that results in loss of brain function. And all of those manifest themselves, along with strokes, in similar but not the same way. And they all take time to recover from because there's precious little that can be done from the outside in the way of surgery. You know, you break a leg, a doctor can mend that for you by putting a cast on it. If you have a break in your brain, there's really precious little that a doctor can do except pray that through time and through the diligence of the survivor that good things happen.
Right, and what is typically, you know, the response in terms of the treatment of a traumatic brain injury? I mean, does the person have to be just kept still as possible? I mean, I know it's going to vary depending on the severity of the injury and what caused it, but what typically are the kinds of things they do for people who
suffer
these incidents?
Well, many people start out with in a coma or a comatose situation, sometimes for several weeks, and so keeping still is not an issue. Once they get started, getting moving again has to be done gradually and with the assistance of physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists. There's a whole array of people that a brain-injured person is likely to need the services of, and that service kicks in as soon as the person is able to accommodate what's being offered to them. I had one of the people that was interviewed for the book, and I did countless interviews. It took a year of at least a year of research before I could really even get a decent start on writing, because you need to understand that although the traditional advice given to writers is that we should write about that which we know something about, the way I got started with this project had me starting on something I knew nothing about. So I had quite a lot to learn, and I've succeeded in doing that, but as I say, it took at least a year before I could really feel confident about putting the first keystrokes into the computer. But I had one therapist tell me that everybody wants to walk. When they recover, many of them have to relearn to walk. And I asked her if that was true or if it was true that everybody said they wanted to relearn walking. And she said, you know, that's an interesting way of thinking about it, because until they take that first step, you don't know whether they mean it or not. And that's the crux of the situation. With brain-injured people, the survivor, be it a stroke or a traumatic brain injury, has to want to fight for recovery, because without fight, nothing good is going to happen.
Right. Now tell us a little bit about Angela's story.
Well, I met Angela in late 2008. She's coming up on her sixth anniversary of the event that caused her brain injury and the loss of her husband's life and so on and so forth. I met Angela here in North Carolina. She had returned to live with her father, come back from New York City to do that, and I met her 4 months after the crash. And I met her again one time every month at a meeting that we were both attending. At the end of the fourth meeting, I went up to her and I said, Angela, I'd like to write your story. Now, as I made that offer, I have to tell you that I really didn't know what kind of story it would turn out to be. I didn't know whether Angela had enough reserve and enough capability to make a recovery that would be about which I would be able to write an inspiring book. I was hopeful. I could see that she was a fighter, but I didn't know Angela, and I really didn't know where her life was going to take her. The other thing that I didn't know, as I've already touched on, is that I knew precious little about brain injuries, and I had a lot to learn in that regard. And the third and probably the biggest thing, by speaking when I did, I wasn't revisiting her recovery years later, say 3 years later or 4 years after it happened. I was stepping into the breach early on, and I was with her a lot of time, traveling around to brain injury conferences, brain injury support groups, and learning and supporting her as best I could. Rank amateur that I was a sounding board for her, and I got to know her so well that if she needed another father, I would be glad to volunteer at this point, because she's such a fabulous person. And you touched on what she lost when she had that car crash. Many people would say she lost it all, had it all, and then lost it all. She was 30 years old in 2008, the vice president of a New York City marketing firm. She was married for less than a year to a man she really loved. who was also successful in a vice presidency in a music firm in New York City. They had owned their home less than 4 months. They're driving home on the Deegan, the New York Thruway, on the border of the city and Yonkers, when a tractor-trailer unexpectedly jumped over the median and crushed their SUV. Her husband, Rich, died at that moment, and as a result of the crash, Angela was not then and still is not able to take on traditional employment opportunities. So she lost him. She, as a result of the crash, she wasn't able to work, so she couldn't pay for the home. That was lost to foreclosure. You listen to her story and you wonder how she could keep smiling as she did and as she continues to do, saying that she knows a lot of people who've had it worse than she has. And I'll tell you the truth, I don't know many people who've had it nearly as bad, but she never quit.
Well, Bill, I have to tell you, I'm getting goosebumps just listening to you share her story and her, God, what a spirit. I mean, she just has such a just a beautiful spirit to be able to have that kind of perspective and go on. I don't know many people that would really take the same approach if, God forbid, presented with the same set of circumstances. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, we complain about trivial things.
Oh, do we ever. Absolutely.
You know?
And yet I was careful in the book not to portray her as one of a kind, one in 50 million. She's not a hero. She doesn't wish to be identified as one, and she is not the only person who has staged a rather complete and dramatic recovery. When I said she's no longer capable of doing traditional employment, it's because of the issues that will probably plague her for years to come and continue through the first 6 years to do so. She has some double vision problems that she needs to work on and have corrective lenses for. She has some cognition issues, which mean that she carries an iPhone that reminds her of upcoming meetings. I was on the phone with her at 12:30, and she was headed for a therapy session at 1 o'clock that the phone undoubtedly had reminded her of more than once today. So she's an advocate for brain injured people, and let me tell you the extent to which that has happened for her. There is, across the country, an association called the Brain Injury Association of America, BIA, Brain Injury Association. And there's a national organization, and each state has an organization. Angela started, as soon as she was able to, in North Carolina, before returning to New York just a year after she had come down here for therapy. And upon her return, she got immediately involved in the activities of BIA in New York City and in the state. She travels to Washington, D.C. with a contingent of people who are survivors and Brain Injury Association executives once a year to Washington, D.C. for National Brain Injury Awareness Day. She's now the chairman of the New York City chapter of the Brain Injury Association and is on the board of the state organization. So she's taking this advocacy very, very seriously. She speaks well and writes incredibly well. And for evidence of that, I would encourage listeners to go to angelaleetucker.com, Angela Lee, L-E-I-G-H, Tucker.com. Click on some of the videos that she's put there, including an interview that she and I were a part of at a book festival here in North Carolina recently, and you'll be overwhelmed by her capability to conduct herself well in an interview on, and that's, as I say, captured on video.
That's fantastic. So that's AngelaLeeTucker.com. I put a link to that in the chat room, Bill, and of course, when listeners listen to the archive, they'll find out about that. I want to encourage everyone to go there, and I will certainly put that out on all of my social media platforms.
Well, I appreciate that
as well. So now, with the book, so tell us a little bit about that process. Now, I know you said it involved a tremendous amount of research and traveling with Angela, and you kind of had a front row seat in her recovery. I guess, you know, what were some of the things you learned, and what was most surprising to you? I mean, anything that you discovered along the way that surprised you?
Well, in brain injury situations, there's something called an S-curve. At the outset, recovery starts very slowly. But if you can picture starting up the slope on an S, after a few weeks, it begins to accelerate, the recovery does. And then near the top, it tends to flatten off a little bit, and that topping out can occur. That occurs at different times for different people, and the strength of their recovery, of course, varies as well. But when they top off a little bit, they're still not done. That's why after 6 years, she's still going to therapy even today. But one of the things that I was pleased to be a part of was her rediscovery of self. She calls herself Angela Part 2 or Angela Number 2 because she's not the same person that she was. But on our first lengthy trip to New York City, I drove her to New York City so we could do interviews with former neighbors, friends, and coworkers, and doctors and therapists. As we're driving up the road, I'm listening as she's making these pronouncements about things that she's remembering. And each time she did, she would smile and say, "Wow, that's a memory." So I felt so privileged to be there as she was regaining these memories from her past. Now, I won't for a moment suggest that she's regained all of them. For example, she can look at her wedding album and know that she's looking at a happy couple, but she can't remember her wedding at all. So there are some permanent memory losses that can be expected, but that doesn't mean life is over. It just means that you've got a new basis for starting life number two.
Well, exactly. Now, is some of the memory loss, I mean, obviously it's from the physical trauma, but is there, I'm asking about the emotional component now. Does that figure in? I would imagine that it does. And if so, to what extent does that affect memory?
It does, and yet Angela, for as a case in point, was not a person who turned easily to drugs to lift her out of depression. She did at one point take a few, but as few as she could take, and wished desperately to get past that point in her recovery. But you can find some survivors. I don't even want to say this, but I will. Some survivors seem to stay stuck in the misery of their loss. And I was just talking to a Brain Injury Association person this morning. We just did an audio version of this book, and we're going to be offering a discussion guide just as soon as we can get it together. The book's just been out since January. And I want to go further with this because so many people continue to need an onward and upward view of life. One of the distressing things that can happen is that survivors sometimes get stuck in the event that caused their brain injury and just don't seem to be able to get past it. And that can be debilitating and depressing for them and for those around them. It's hard for a brain injury survivor to be assured that people who were friends in the past, even family members, are going to cleave to them in the future if they persist in that kind of negative speak, if you can imagine that. So it's imperative that a survivor take on a can-do attitude and do the best they can with it. Otherwise, they risk driving everyone around them out of the room.
Wow. Yeah, my gosh, that is such an important insight. And, you know, and speaking of survivors and caregivers, Bill, what was, you know, as you were doing your research and interviewing the people around Angela, friends, family, coworkers, was there a sort of a common theme, or what was some of the biggest feedback that you got, or
well,
that you remember?
I would say the common theme was the goodness of people, and I was particularly impressed by the goodness of people in New York. I knew people here in Western North Carolina were good people. I've lived here since 1989. And I have this big city bias that says New York City people don't care about each other. Well, as it turns out, I couldn't have been further from correct on that. There were wonderful people everywhere we went, and they were not all being paid or paid well to be the kind of people that they were. It wasn't a matter of them making a lot of money for what they did. That's certainly true of Life Flight paramedics and other people that we met, the therapists, for example, not terribly well paid at times and overworked certainly in a very stressful situation. So I came away from the writing experience and the total experience with a dear friend in Angela, but also a lot of new friends across the country that I can think about and call on today if I needed anything.
Wow, that is so great to hear. Kind of, you know, we never hear about the goodness of humanity, you know, in the news or in the media most of the time, and it's just, it's so so uplifting.
It is. It's incredible. And keep in mind, brain-injured people are not necessarily the easiest people to deal with. You can, when a person has been blinded or when a person has had an amputation, you can speak to them about it and not feel that you're maybe violating their space. When you meet a brain-injured person who is succeeding in recovery, how do you get into that subject? When you see in them something that doesn't seem quite normal, which is a word I came to hate, because we're all abnormal in our own way. When you see someone who's had a brain injury, it's first difficult to identify that because they'll look right at you and speak very, very well. But when you're around them enough, as a family member or dear friend would be, you know there are things that they aren't doing. Do you accuse them of being slack in their responsibility to self and to you, or do you deal with it? And that's why a lot of people will, over time, be driven away from, prospectively, a difficult brain injury situation. We met so many people. One young man who had struggled for recovery for 5 years and was only able to move his eyes and had never given up. Another man, after 17 years, an older fellow, had lost his sense of taste. We had lunch with him, and he pointed out that the only reason he ever ate was to survive because he couldn't taste or smell anything. These are some of the things that people who have suffered brain injuries are left with, and it puts them at a point of having to make a choice. Do I eat, or do I just eat poorly or starve to death? And this man had persisted, with the help of his wife, in eating nutritionally sound food 3 times a day, and was otherwise healthy. The only loss he suffered permanently was the loss of taste and smell.
Wow.
And they're just story after story that I came across that inspired me. So, in fact, when I talk in public places about Angela and about this whole issue of brain injuries, I am overwhelmed to the point that I need to take a moment to get my voice back. After all this time and my familiarity with her and with these situations, it still overwhelms me at times to think about them.
Now, Bill, let me ask you, is there any place online, on YouTube or anywhere, that people could see videos of you and Angela speaking?
Yeah, that would be on the Angela Lee Tucker website, and
okay.
Just click on videos. I can get there in a moment here, I think. Want to be sure that I'm sending you to the right link on that website.
Okay, no, that's great, because, and again, that's Angela Lee, L-E-I-G-H, Tucker.com.
Correct.
For anyone who would like to check that out. I think that, you know, it would be, I'm glad that they're on there, because I'm looking forward to, after the show, checking them out myself.
Click on the top line, you'll see talks, and those are video talks, and you'll see the two of us there when we were interviewed in April regarding this book. She's delightful, and people will know that when they see these videos.
Now, Bill, does she do this full time now, or her advocacy work?
When she's not involved with her own therapy and her own needs, she's advocating. She has to be careful in not taking on too many one-on-one situations, but she will reach out to individuals from time to time. When I say she has to be careful, there are lots of people and only one of her, and you can understand that she has to use a multiplier effect in speaking to audiences and not spending all of her time in one-on-one situations with people who are in recovery. But she does what she can for individuals and, of course, collectively for audiences that she speaks to.
Well, that's wonderful. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that I there was a real payoff for me. I'd always wondered, and this is what intrigued me about writing this Me Now, Who Next book that we wrote. The payoff was in understanding why some people fight as hard as they do when, I would say, far too many of us give up. Someone gives up on life because they've had a divorce or they've lost a job or they've, the reasons I would call some of those excuses when you contrast them to what Angela Lee Tucker has gone through and succeeded in overcoming largely.
Exactly, Bill. I mean, there are people who just, throw their hands up and quit over much lesser events.
Right.
And it's you wonder if it's, I know there are people who are very spiritual who would look at that as sort of a soul thing, which I tend to look at it as well. But, it sounds like she just has an indomitable spirit within.
She does, and I got to tell you, she's a very spiritual person too, and that hasn't hurt her at all. In fact, it's been a good part of the reason why she's been able to get as far along as she has. And I still expect great things from her. The three things that she lost that she wanted to recover, and she's recovering some, she used to be able to sing beautifully. She wants to get her singing voice back. And a lot of that loss occurred when they had to trach her. Part of it was brain injury related, but part of it was significant damage to her vocal cords at the night of the crash. But she's once again able to sing. She's wanting to meet the second love of her life, and I think one day she'll succeed in doing that. She's just 36 years old, and she stays in great shape. Physically, she works out and eats carefully. And if there are any single men out there listening today, I would recommend that you find Angela Lee Tucker or somebody like her, because she's a lot of fun.
So, Bill, you're an author and a matchmaker.
Correct. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah, I guess I'm guilty as charged.
So now, Bill, I want to talk a little bit about more into the process of the book. Now, you released it this past January of 2014, correct?
Right. Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, all e-readers, and now in audio on Amazon.com or Audible.com, and it's doing well. I have to tell you, I prefer to start another book and let this one take care of itself, but all of us who write realize that part of what's left to do after you've put a nice-looking wrapper around it is that you've got to get out there with the word about the book, because people are not going to discover it otherwise. So
yeah,
I'm reluctantly marketing, and I must say reluctantly, because I'd much rather write.
Yeah, I understand that. Believe me, we say, I'm in a writer's group on Facebook, and the big joke is that, congratulations, you finished your book. Now the real work begins.
That's right. Yeah, I'm in a couple of writer's groups, and there's a group here in North Carolina called the North Carolina Writers Network, which I would recommend to anyone. It's all writers of all shapes, sizes, and types, and it's a good group, and as I say, a couple of local groups here in the mountains that sustain and feed me, and I try to do the same for them. Writers are a lot of fun to be around, and anyone that's listening who is contemplating writing, don't expect it to be easy. That would be my recommendation. It's joyful, but it's a lot of work to do it well. I would like to think that I've done it well. I'm so pleased that to date we've had a dozen or so reviews, and they've all been 5-star reviews, and I never they're legitimate reviews, because I never ask anybody to write a review, It's just not what I'm not geared that way. But a sample of the book, you know, for those that haven't gone to Amazon.com, you can call up the title Me Now, Who Next? And actually read a few of the pages of the book. They do that. It's a service that I think too many people, there may be many people who don't know that that's out there. It's nice to be able to read a few pages to get a determination about the interest you might have in that book before you plunk down whatever money you have to pay for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love, you know, I think new technology has really opened up so many opportunities for authors, especially new authors. But so, Bill, I'm assuming that you independently published Angela's book, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Used Amazon's Create Space. No regrets about that, whatever. I'm 72 years old, and one of the pieces of advice that I hear bandied about between writers is take time and build your brand. And I often remind people at 72, you have a whole new definition of what time represents. And so I was not feeling myself in a position of going out and seeking an agent and trying to find a publisher and going through that whole process when I knew in my heart that this book needed to be out there because its message is so important. I often tell people, don't buy this book because I wrote it. Buy it because of what I wrote it about, the person that I wrote it about, Angela Tucker. Reading about her, I believe, will change prospectively the life of the reader. It's just that inspiring a message. And I didn't have to fictionalize it to make it that way. She's an inspiring person. And all I had to do was observe and reflect on what I'd seen and get it on paper.
Excellent. Well, and your point about time is so well taken, Bill. And even, you know, for much younger authors, too, it's funny. I self-published my first book in 2008, and at the time I was editing a book for a friend, and her book was nonfiction. It was a health and wellness type of book. And I watched her jump through all of these hoops trying to get a literary agent. By the time she did all that, I had written my book and published it. And she finally said, you know what, I'm going to do the same thing. And, you know, the fact of the matter is in today's publishing world, too, I mean, if you're not a big name, you know, huge author that these publishing houses see dollar signs when they look at you, if you're not a big name celebrity, for example, they're not going to take a chance. And the thing is, even in that case, that person still takes on a lot of the marketing responsibility anyway.
Absolutely.
So I feel, you know, so why not make more of the profits? They're going to have to work a lot harder. But I think the marketing side of it is fun. I mean, what do you think?
Well, it's not as much fun as the writing for me, but it is. You know, I take this show that we're doing here today on WriteStream. I appreciate being on the show. I'm enjoying this experience. And this would have to be considered as a part of the exposure of Me Now, Who Next, the book. And I'm getting a great kick out of that. But to slog around to the few remaining independent bookstores and try to do a signing, as you know, is kind of a dead-end trip for anybody that chooses to make it, including, by the way, some rather well-known writers. I have seen the bookstore signing model fail for, I won't name their names, but nationally recognized bestseller-type authors with major publishers. My wife and I will go out to their signing and find that the two of us and maybe two or three other people are there for a well-publicized event. So bookstore signings are kind of, fool's gold, I guess.
Yeah, well, and now, I mean, so many people love Kindle. I mean, at the time in 2008, I mean, it was just really starting to take off. And now, I forget what the exact statistics are, but it's pretty close to, I think, half of readers prefer Kindle over paperback. Maybe that number is even a little bit higher. So
I think you're right. It's right at half.
Half. Yeah, and so if you have to serve that market, that growing market, and you can't blame people in a way, especially if they don't know the author. I think they'll take a chance and they'll spend $3, $4, or $5, whatever it is for the Kindle version,
That's right.
A little bit of their time than they will, like, fork over $20 for a paperback.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciated your mentioning my blog, and for the writers that may be listening, let me tell you that the reason I do the blog that I do at Bill Ramsey, BillRamseyAuthor.wordpress.com, is that doing a blog once every 3 days, which is the frequency that I choose, in about 200 words on something that I've been thinking about, improves my thinking and definitely improves my writing. And if folks are not actively doing a blog, they might want to consider that as a way to facilitate their thinking and writing skills.
Oh, amen to that, Bill. I talk about that all the time. I could not agree with you more. And it's amazing. Go ahead.
I didn't know that you were a blogger until I heard you say so today, and I'm going to sign up for your blog and see what you're doing there. I'm sure I'll learn something from it. I find writers' blogs, the ones that I've found that are good, that are not excessively self-promoting. I mean, you can do a blog that just bores people to death by over-promoting your book day after day after day. But as I say, I write real-life issues once every 3 days, and I write them concisely, as I did in an essay book in 2013 called Now That I Think About It. But I'm continuing the process of exploring various topics in that blog, and I hope some folks will use this opportunity to hook up with that blog and see whether you like it.
Yeah, and Bill, you made another excellent point, and that is engagement with social media. Nobody wants to be sold anything, and it's so true that the blog really needs to be a vehicle to connect with your readers on topics that interest you and them, you know, something that they're going to connect with, that's going to speak to them. And it can't always be about buy my book, here's my book, you know, go here to purchase my book. In fact, that should be probably, that should be less than half of what you spend your time on.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the blog talk radio is also a great outlet. And I'm finding that authors don't know enough about that. A particular writers group that I meet with had 15 writers 2 weeks ago, and I said, how many of you have been using Blog Talk Radio or have appeared there? Not a single hand went up, and they wanted to know more about Blog Talk Radio. So you're in a sweet spot, a spot that I'm sure will develop in time and is already doing so, because there's a number of successful Blog Talk Radios that focus on writing and the product of writers, and they're really important to this whole process.
Well, thank you. You know, Bill, one of the many reasons I started this network was I saw a need for, just kind of like what you just said, for so many writers to be able to talk about their work, because like it or not, and this gets back to the whole marketing side of things, nobody knows your book as well as you do and your motivation for writing it, and if you cannot explain that in a way that's compelling, and I know not everybody's a professional speaker, but, you know, this platform is, I mean, I've been on Blog Talk Radio since 2008, on other, you know, I had another show for 4 years and been a guest various times, and it's such a great way to, you know, it's like you get to practice while you're promoting, you know, because each time you do it, you get better, and I listen to old broadcasts I've done, and you know, and I'm always identifying what I can do better. One of those
Absolutely.
Things is to talk slower.
Right.
and I'm not really succeeding too well at that. But you know what I'm saying? It's such a great platform for many different reasons. And I think because you don't have to be, you know, visible. You know, there's a little bit of a comfort level to it, and it's just a great platform for writers.
Well, and I've been told many times that I've got a face for radio, so I'm glad to be on radio and not on live TV somewhere. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, look, if had it not been for Blog Talk Radio, you and I would not have met, and for me, that would not have been a good outcome. I'm so glad to have had this opportunity because of what you do and your commitment to what you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, and I just, you know, it also helps me. I love to talk to different authors and, you know, get their professional opinion on different things, learn something new, regarding a topic that I today's topic on traumatic brain injury. I mean, I find it really fascinating. And like you said, too, I mean, and I agree, there's nothing as inspiring as real life when you find a real person who's overcome tremendous obstacles and is using that experience to help other people the way Angela is doing. So my pleasure
to
have you on the
air. And part of what any of us who write need to do, and you know this is true, for the non-writers out there, you need to know that writers spend an awful lot of time, as much time as we can muster, reading books by other people and other items that they have written. And I just put down a tremendous book written, I think, in 2010 by Laura Hillenbrand called Unbroken, and I'm sure you've heard about that one, about the World War II suffering of a particular soldier who had been an Olympian for prior to his World War II enlistment, and what a horrific experience he had in the war and in prisoner camps. And so, yeah, you can get great life inspiration from books from various authors on various topics.
Yeah, my gosh, that sounds like a wonderful book. I think I have heard of it. I'm going to have to read that.
Yes,
certainly,
Unbroken.
Certainly puts things into perspective, again, getting back to, you know, some of the minor trials and tribulations of life that many of us allow, to hold us down. And then you read a story like that and you think, you know, my problems really aren't so bad.
They sure aren't. Let me, do we have a minute yet?
Absolutely, Bill. We've got 10 more minutes, so
okay.
We're good.
Let me tell you about a cause that more writers ought to pick up on. I have recently discovered that the small public library in my boyhood hometown near Washington, Pennsylvania, down in southwest Pennsylvania, Houston, Pennsylvania, tiny little town with a small library, has been threatened by reduction in its annual budget to the point that it may not survive. This is happening in public libraries all around the country, not just small libraries. And writers need to take a stand when they see a local library being threatened, because we need the resources of the library for the research that we do, and we need a place to put our books. And if people aren't able to afford to buy a book, having one of our books in a library is a smart place to be. So I'm now from afar hooking up Pittsburgh area writers with the library cause, and I'm going to go up and lead a writer's workshop on the 9th of September at 1 o'clock in the little town of Houston, Pennsylvania, the Chartiers Houston Community Library. So if you've got a library that's failing near you and you're a writer out there in the sound of my voice, take a stand. Don't let that library go down in flames, because you can make a difference.
Definitely. And, you know, Bill, I have a couple of friends in the Pittsburgh area, so I'm going to mention this to them. One of them is author Harriet Park. I can't remember the name of her town, but she's in a suburb of Pittsburgh.
Okay.
So I will definitely pass it along. That would be a terrible thing, because, like you said, for people who can't afford books or Kindle, I mean, you know, we want people to read. More people reading is definitely a good thing, and we certainly want them to have access to books. And like you said, you brought up another great point. I donated a couple of books to libraries myself, because the point is, get your story out there let it inspire somebody. Maybe somebody
Absolutely.
That can never repay you, but, you know, you're doing something good.
Well, and that's particularly true with this brain injury recovery book about Angela Tucker, you know, the Me Now Who Next book. I want it out there just because people need to. There are a lot more people walking around. Her own father, for example, told me that he'd been kicked in the head by a horse as a youth and knocked unconscious. And he said, you know, when Angela suffered her injury, he said, I reflected on my own and thought, there's been a few things missing in my life that I can trace back to that event. So the smallest of concussions, particularly since they can be cumulative in their impact on the person who suffers them, to a point where a traumatic brain injury can result. I'll give you an example from the book. a physician who practiced in Colorado, Cheryl Sullivan, I met here in Asheville. She had a succession of minor concussions over the course of her life, starting in her youth. The last one of five resulted when she stood on at the end of the day on her skis at the bottom of the ski run, and her skis went out from under her, and she banged the back of her head, and that was the end of her practice of medicine. So,
oh my goodness!
If you've had a concussion, and though you've had it, and it's been a knockout event for you, be aware that these are cumulative, and you probably never really shake all of the after effect. You see it happen a lot in football, for example, where a succession of concussions will cause a player who has suffered them to retire early. You know, had three or four concussions and just realizes that one more could be their undoing, and they give up the game. So lots of
yeah.
things to look out for if you've had that experience.
Absolutely. Well, Bill, now where else can people find you on social media? I know you have your blogs. Are you on Twitter or Facebook or any other platforms, LinkedIn, anything like that?
I am on Facebook, but I don't make much use of it. I find an awful lot of stuff crowding out other things on Facebook. You know, it's really a crowded field out there. When you go to a person's blog, you go by choice. If you friend them through Facebook, they can slap you in the face with a daily entry, and they're just one of perhaps dozens of people who do that, and it's tedious. I mean, I use Facebook more to find out what my nieces and nephews are up to than for any other reason. Just keeping an eye on the nieces and nephews.
Well, there you go. See, you know, it's funny. It's different people have different opinions on it, and that's why it's good that there is so much variety out there in the platforms
absolutely.
That we choose to use.
Right.
So, you know, and again, that's the nice thing about new technology. I think it's really made it possible. And I know we only have a couple minutes left, but the one thing I did want to mention too, when we were on this topic, is the need. I always tell authors, though, you know, you really, especially if you're going to go the independent route, that's great, but have a budget and even if it's a small budget, spend it wisely and make sure that, you know, all your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed, that you get
absolutely.
proper editing and
but
still
let me tell you
the quality out there.
The self-publishing can give you an excuse which you should never allow yourself, and that is an excuse to be sloppy with what you produce. I had pre-readers, demanding pre-readers, including therapists, some five of them, that sent word back to me about what needed to be changed about this book to make it more easy to understand and flow and coherent and accurate and all of that. And that all happened before I hired an editor and paid an editor to do two editings. Then I hired a cover designer and a layout expert. So, yeah, you need a budget. You can produce an e-book or even a printed book through one of your on-demand print services, and there are numerous ones of those. As I say, I used CreateSpace. But you owe it to yourself and to the people who might read your work not to have it be sloppy. And you do have to have a budget to make sure that that happens, and you have to take your time. You have to rewrite a whole lot more than you'd like to, because
mm-hmm.
one time through doesn't do it. I hate to be – I'm not trying to lecture, but it is an issue, and you started it, so I'll finish that part of this conversation.
Well, you know, Bill, and honestly, we all have a stake in this, too. I mean, you know –
yes, we do.
Because we're all under a bigger microscope being, quote-unquote, self-published than an author – like it or not, than an author is with a traditionally published company. And so, you know, the more other independent authors can take the proper steps and put something out there of quality, you know, the better it is for all of us.
Absolutely. And the fact that a book is done by a publisher doesn't necessarily make it any darn better than a self-published book that was properly put together. Well,
right.
Hey, I've enjoyed this. I know you need a minute or two to wrap up, and thanks so much for having me on. It's been pure pleasure.
Well, Bill, same here, and thank you so much. And I'm going to be purchasing the book today because I'm looking forward to reading it.
Bless your heart.
Okay, Thanks. Take care now. All right,
bye-bye.
All right, everyone, that was author Bill Ramsey. You can check out his blog at billramseyblog.wordpress.com and his book, Me Now, Who Next, at his other blog, lifeswrite.com, lifeswrite.com. So I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break with Madison Rising Star Spangled Banner just before the right-wing riot stampedes the airwaves. So stay tuned, everybody.
Listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag WriteStream. Thanks for listening to the WriteStream Radio Network.
Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the WriteStream Radio Network. Tune in to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, author, military historian, and journalist. John delves into a unique aspect of U.S. military history, as well as current events and issues affecting our men and women in uniform. Featuring exceptional guests, military experts, and authors, Military Monday with John D. Gresham entertains, informs, and encourages listeners to support those who put it all on the line for freedom. Military Monday with John D. Gresham. Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the WriteStream Radio Network.
All right, everyone, I think...
Welcome to another edition of The Right Wing Riot with your hosts, the scary smart Jamie K. Wilson.
Every morning when I get late, should I go in and report to my boss?
The mysterious and alluring Ms. Always Right.
Do we think that this is going to start being as obviously stupid to everyone as it is to us?
And Griff Griffiths, who is the Prince of White Men. Let's get this riot started!
Here at the Right Wing Riot. I don't know. Am I live? I'm asking my goddess host, Daria Ann DiGiovanni. I think I'm live.
Yes, Griff, you are live because I just enlivened your microphone.
Wow. Okay. Well, I didn't say anything important, so we'll keep right on going.
You probably shouldn't enliven it too much.
Oh, come on now. That hurts me. But... since the pain is starting early, I'm going to disappoint everybody and let them know that the mysterious and alluring Ms. Always Right is away from the microphone at this moment. She's doing some research for a tasty story we're going to get to you next week. However, our friend, the equally lovely and alluring and probably mysterious too, Ms. Daria Ann DiGiovanni is joining us. As we leap into another week of mockery and sarcasm, and then we'll get to the politics.
Mm-hmm.
But let's see, anybody have anything new and interesting to tell us about themselves? Ms. Scary Smart, anything cool going on with you these days?
Well, Liberty Island Mag is supposed to have a new edition out today, and I'm supposed to have a feature story in it.
And you do. I just checked that.
Oh, it's up now? Awesome.
Yes, ma'am. You want to tell us about that?
Well, it's just a little thing I wrote about. Well, I was asking myself, why is it that it's okay to change your gender but not your race? So I wrote a story about that.
You're going right for the controversial, aren't you?
No, I would never do that.
I have read this story, and Darianne, I know you'll probably pop over and take a look at it when you get a chance. It was a good piece of work with all of the wit and irreverence and basic disrespect that we've come to expect here on the riot.
Awesome.
But,
I can't wait to check that out.
And Daria, anything new and exciting in Ms. DiGiovanni's world?
What is new and exciting? Well, you know, I got a new book review yesterday that just made my whole Monday for a book I wrote in 2008. So it's always exciting when that happens.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
What did they say that you found particularly joyful and uplifting?
You know, it's gratifying when you can tell if the person that aside from the universal themes, that the person really that it touched them in some way. And this interview, it was actually Daniela Bova, who's also an author and a member of the CLFA herself. And it was just coming from a genuine place. And it's just nice to know that, you know, someone appreciates that they took something of value away from it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So it just made my whole day because I had insomnia the night before. It was a really long Monday. And then I read that, like, later in the day, and it just made my whole day. So thank you, Daniela.
Awesome. We'll have to talk to her some more sometime later. But right now, there's some important things we need to discuss. Mm-hmm. As soon as the soundboard works for me. I don't think that's loud enough. However, that leads us into, in our usual subtle and understated way, to a discussion that is long overdue and long ignored, actually, especially in the morally superior media. Progressivism, good or bad, scary smart.
Do we even know what it is? Does anyone know what it is? Originally it was supposed to be about progress and the use of science and technology and social sciences and stuff like that to make everyone's lives better by progressing.
Hence the name.
I don't think it's about that anymore. Yeah, exactly. But I don't think it's about that anymore.
All right. Well, putting on my serious voice for a moment, people look at Obama, that would be the current president of the United States, the empty suit in chief, as the very embodiment of progressivism. And I believe that Scary Smart doesn't see it that way. That, in fact, he's not, he's an embodiment. But is the problem really having an empty suit, a man of no accomplishment in the White House, the problem? Well, yes, in fact, it is. But besides that, you know, an empty suit I'm thinking a Republican empty suit might be less problematic than a progressive empty suit. Your thoughts, Ms. Smart?
If we knew what he stood for. The thing is, progressivism is a Rorschach. We don't really know what it is anymore. Obama is also a Rorschach. We have no idea what the man is or what he stands for. Hope and change. What does that mean?
You know, I just felt better when you said that. Yeah.
Is that what it means? You feel better, so you vote yes? Is that the idea? You don't have to think about it. Just go by your gut, and if it makes you feel good, you do it. That's kind of 60s there, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. So you said we don't know what he stands for. You know, okay.
He stands for himself.
Clearly. What I thought was interesting about Obama supporters, if you put aside the creepy cult-like behavior, the chanting of his name, the women being smote by the Holy Spirit on seeing him talk. All that aside, I decided he was a dream catcher. He was just this empty vessel that all of these people, a lot of them very white, poured their hopes and dreams into. That's how I interpreted the fact we don't know what the guy stands for other than self-interest, and it's always somebody else's fault. The guy has never taken responsibility for a thing in his life, as far as I can tell.
Let's dig into something you just said, though. You just said most of his voters were very white. Why does that matter? Why should it matter today? And what does that have to do with progressivism?
Darnie, any thoughts on that? I have my own opinion, but Daria?
I actually have a different opinion. I think those of us who pay attention know exactly what he stands for, and it's what's happening right now. I mean, unfortunately, progressivism is a cancer that's affected both parties. And in the case mm-hmm. of Obama, all we have to do is look at the multitude of scandals that I've lost track of. That are deliberately designed to aid in the fundamental, quote-unquote, transformation of America, i.e., the destruction of whatever was left of our capitalistic free market society, into something we don't really want to go, into something we don't recognize, which is socialism and eventually just total control. I mean, the left is all about, they're control freaks. It's the agenda of control. So I think we know what he stands for. Maybe the average person doesn't, and they fell for it. And I do agree with the whole Rorschach thing. But unfortunately, it's like Tony Robbins used to talk about transformational vocabulary. And I think that's exactly what the word progressive, I think, is an example of that, because they've gotten so many people duped into believing that it stands for something that it really doesn't. I would submit that the real quote-unquote radicals, the real trailblazers, the real cool guys, were the guys in 1776 who said, you know what? We're sick of this. We're going to forge a nation where the individual is in control of his own destiny.
That's really interesting, because you can trace Enlightenment itself back to about the same time period. Both progressivism and our American Revolution came out of progressivism, or came out of the Enlightenment. So in a lot of ways, we're actually two rival philosophies.
Okay.
And right now, progressivism is trying to strangle the American Revolution.
Okay, I'm going to make a note of that, because I want to get back to that. But,
okay.
You know, you did. I just wanted to answer the question why you thought it was why I pointed out that a lot of the voters were white. A lot of these, you know, people having the mm-hmm. the spiritual experience and calling him the light bringer, and that kind of thing. Well, first, you said, what is progressivism? And I was thinking, and I can't remember the Supreme Court justice who said, I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. Mm-hmm. Progressivism has moved into that kind of sphere of again, you said feelings. People are talking about their feelings, and you know, it feels progressive. And that goes to why I think a great deal of otherwise smart voters who happen to be of the pasty complexion persuasion voted for Obama when, you know, clearly the man had no accomplishment. Even Hillary Clinton said, if John McCain's done this, I've done that. And meanwhile, Barack Obama's got this great speech he gave somewhere. Of course, she was racist for saying that, and that's a whole other discussion. But I think a lot of these white progressives, since progressivism is their religion these days, it is their faith. Voting for Obama was a tenet of their faith, because it was they can't take communion, but they can vote and support the black candidate to prove that they're good people. Okay, I've just killed the discussion right there.
No, it's just that's so depressing.
Yeah.
It's so depressing, but you're right.
Absolutely. I just wanted to say, you guys, when you think about it, his two big voting blocks are ultra-wealthy white liberals, who I just think suffer from white liberal guilt. I mean, some of these are the same people you see on videos on YouTube claiming that they want to give up their whiteness, that being white makes them ashamed of themselves. And again, it's because it makes them feel morally superior. And then his other big voting block are people who just, don't want to get up and work every day and be productive. I mean, I hate to say it like that, but I think it's the truth.
No, I think you're right.
There
truth
does seem to be a lot of that.
Truth is more important than feeling bad about what you say.
Yeah.
Always say the truth, even if it makes you feel bad. If it's the truth, it's the truth.
Truth has no agenda, right? So.
Exactly.
That became another interesting progressive trait was language. The recasting of language so that it words mean what we want them to mean, other than in fact what they mean.
I have a story about that.
Please, let's hear it. And can you speak up a little bit, Scary Smart? You're a little faint.
I'm just not close enough to the stupid microphone. It's set too low on my thing. Back in the 90s, I did a hell of a lot of temporary work because, you know, I went and got an English degree, and there's just not a whole lot you can do with an English degree in Louisville, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked as a temp in a lot of places. And one of the places I worked was at the power company there in Louisville in the legal department. And I was appalled to find that one of the main tools that the lawyers used there was simply redefining words. They were redefining pollution in one court case to eliminate particle, like particles dropping from the air onto your cars, to eliminate that as pollution. And they were expected, I think they actually did get that through court. They won that case. So they didn't have to pay these people for the damage that had been done to their cars. That made me start watching language from that point forward. And I should have watched it before being an English major, right?
Mm-hmm.
But have you ever thought that that's one of the main rhetorical tools that lawyers use? And there are an awful lot of lawyers who are also progressive. They're using exactly the same tool set.
Okay, which would explain why we have bills in Congress, many of them lawyers, that are
absolutely
1,500 pages long.
Written so you can't understand them, filled with words that get redefined.
Yep.
What is healthcare? What is healthcare? Is healthcare having a doctor's hands on you, taking care of you? Or is healthcare finding somebody to pay for your birth control pills? They're not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been
that's
redefined.
True.
And it's been redefined in the public sphere. I mean, if we started looking around at the different words the progressives use, an awful lot of the topics that we argue about, we're not really arguing about the word. We're not arguing about the thing that it used to be. We're arguing about the thing the progressives insisted is today. And that's
do
a problem.
Does an example of that come to mind to you, Jamie?
Well, I mean, healthcare is right there on the top, but racism. Racism is right there. What is racism today? You're not allowed to say anything bad about President Obama, because if you do, you're a racist. But that's freedom of speech. That's political speech. You can't have free political speech today without fearing being called a racist. And they're doing as much as they can to make what they call hate speech illegal. I've seen case after case coming through lately where that's what they're doing with it. They're trying to make it not just socially unacceptable, but legally unacceptable.
Okay, I can see that because I think of the trend of the new academic trend of microaggressions.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That starts to sound like a kid's game where you're making shit up, basically. You know, that this becomes that this minor, and the word micro, I think, should be the tip-off, this incredibly minor thing is a microaggression that causes psychic pain to some poor, oppressed individual living in the richest country in the world
mm-hmm.
and often going to a expensive university.
And it only takes one person to feel that pain for the whole thing to be bad.
Apparently so. And, you know, the idea, suck it up, is something taught in college classes these days.
Oh, that's reserved for the Marine Corps.
Yeah, gee whiz. And some of this stuff is so thoroughly ridiculous. Mark Levin had a, you know, he uses the word statist, but I think it's pretty much the progressive platform, just a matter of terminology there, which I guess we have to iron out amongst ourselves as well. But yeah, the idea, he said that a statist, because the world is not perfect and is not utopian, what we have in this moment must be destroyed. It must be torn down because it is not perfect. And, of course, the only people who are going to provide us with that perfect world are the progressives, are the statists. And the microaggression thing is like that. It's a lot of the infantilizing of people that, you are such a delicate creature walking through the world. You must be protected. Even though, of course, you're a good feminist and you're strong and you're just as good as a man, damn it, as long as he pays for your birth control. But you are so delicate that you must be protected from these microaggressions. They must be stamped out under statute and law and so on and so on.
Taxpayers must fund your abortions, whether they believe in them or not.
True.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's not enough to have the legal right to kill your unborn child. Other people must pay for that right.
Yep. Because that's health care.
And there's another word that has been being constantly redefined as the word right. You know, healthcare is a right.
Mm-hmm.
Paying for Sandra Fluke's birth control is a right. And that reminds me, when we get the Right Wing Riot website up, Scary Smart, I want to start a new movement, which is basically, I'll pay for Sandra Fluke's birth control when she pays my ammunition, and then we can start a discussion on what is an actual explicit right, such as the right to keep and bear arms, Second Amendment, and the right to have birth control paid for by the rest of America.
We need to come up with a really good, catchy title for that.
Okay, and I know you can do it. I have faith in you.
Oh, thank you.
Can we also explore the topic of why the same crowd that whines for government to stay out of the bedroom wants that same government to put their hands in taxpayers' wallets to fund bedroom consequences and activities?
Do we have to? I want to rip people apart who've talked about this. This drives me absolutely crazy. You either either want the government in the bedroom or want the government out of the bedroom. Don't do this. They can only be in the bedroom if they're to watch and enjoy, you know?
Lord. It's a terrific point, and Jamie and I are slowly building the campaign for my perfect political candidate, and I think it was last week we came up with slogan two, which is, when it comes to the socialist, the slogan is, if you want it, you pay for it. But I think, and I agree with you, Daria, absolutely, of course. And that's why I was talking about asking Sandra Fluke to pay for my ammunition, because if we're talking about paying for other people's rights, why isn't she paying for mine? But I think, unfortunately, this is one of the things conservative libertarian fights about. Unfortunately, at one point in time, the Republicans were saying, hey, we're going to get the government out of your, you know, out of your life, but at the same time, then they were wanting to put them in the doctor's office, when we're getting to things like abortion and stuff like that. So the libertarian in me has some issues with it, even though, I think abortion's icky, and the idea of using it as your first line of birth control is a sign of, I think, real moral bankruptcy. But in that case, I think the Republicans have contributed a little bit to that the lack of principle in that area. But of course, certainly, the left has made it has become another act of faith in a religion, is that there is no principle. It's only if it bothers us, then we complain about it. It doesn't matter if we said it was bad last week. This week, it's okay.
Well, and here's the other thing, Prince and Scary Smart. I mean, abortion, okay, so taxpayers are forced to fund abortion clinics, which are classified, I guess, as health care providers, yet they're not held to any kind of a standard. I mean, let me point out the God's Mail case. And the irony of a moderate Republican governor, Tom Ridge, relaxing those standards even more, not holding these clinics to the same standard as other health care facilities. And again, I use that term loosely with respect to an abortion clinic. But, you know, so it's like they want to have their cake and eat it too. And I think that the GOP missed a huge opportunity to make the connection between Hillary Clinton and Margaret Sanger, and the fact that I believe in 2012 alone, Planned Parenthood raked in $542 million of our tax dollars, which they then turn around and give to progressive politicians who, when they get elected or reelected, enact policies to further erode our freedoms. I just wish when the issue came up, and I'm not saying let's base the whole campaign around abortion. Here's my point, though. We need to have candidates who can expertly, adequately deal with that gotcha question, because you know it's going to come up every time there's a Republican candidate, whether or not they're trying to make this a focus or not. And I think that's where libertarians and conservatives can agree. I mean, you know, I understand that Roe versus Wade is not going to be overturned, as unconstitutional as it is. But if we're going to be libertarian about it, it really is a states' rights issue, and people in each state should have had the ability to vote on it.
Agreed. Definitely. I don't disagree with that. Scary?
That reminds me of something I'm kind of in the middle of reading. It's David Horowitz. Manuscript. It's available online, called Barack Obama's Rules for Revolution, and he points out how closely Barack Obama follows the Alinsky method. And hold on, let me find this line here. He talks about how Alinsky kept repeating the issue is not the issue.
Oh, yeah.
The revolution is always the issue.
Yep.
And the philosophy of gathering as much power and as much money as you possibly can, no matter how you do it, just in order to fund the revolution. You have to use every issue as a means to fund the revolution. And the revolution, of course, eventually was supposed to bring down America. Now, of course, if you come out and you say something like this in public or in the news, you're going to get poo-pooed and cast aside as some crazy, you know, tinfoil hat guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's in black and white. Obama used to teach this to people. Hillary Clinton wrote her thesis.
I believe it was on Alinsky.
Yeah, she sat and talked to Alinsky about this. She thought Alinsky was just a bomb.
Yeah.
But this stuff is crazy if we start bringing it up and using it against them. But
true.
Every time a government program gets put in place, whether it's by the progressives or by the, you know, supposed conservatives, the money is sucked up, you know, it's hoovered up so that the progressives can use it to further their revolution.
Indeed.
I don't understand why nobody sees this.
We may have to add that to my perfect presidential candidate's slogans. Let's see. No sucking my money, something like that. But
hoovering my wallet.
I will say, guys, Dinesh D'Souza brings that up in the movie America, Imagine the World Without Her. There's a whole section in the movie about Hillary Clinton and her affiliation with Saul Alinsky. Very good. Very well done.
Mm-hmm. I've got to see that movie.
Yeah, we'll come back to Planned Parenthood, because I agree with you when people are saying, you know, they give. I do ask, and it's like, why are we giving tax money to Planned Parenthood? Why are we forcing people who disagree with abortion to have their tax money go to Planned Parenthood? And the response I got was, well, Planned Parenthood doesn't use that money for abortions. So my next question is, do they give Planned Parenthood a special color money just to know that, you know, we're not going to use the green, you know, the blue money doesn't go to abortion. You know, it's like these people are economic idiots. And that, you know, the more money we give Planned Parenthood, that means that's the less money they have to spend buying their own office supplies, and then they can spend more money on abortions because they aren't having to support themselves in other ways. But, of course, we're talking economics.
Another story about that. Again, work temp everywhere. I worked at United Way for a while. Now, if you're not familiar with United Way, they go around to businesses and they promote United Way and they get money and then they distribute that money, redistribution, they distribute mm-hmm. that money to all of the charities that work in that area. And they're a little Planned Parenthood, or not Planned Parenthood, I'm sorry, a little United Way is all over the place. Well, one of the things that you can do in United Way, and by the way, the, there's a government campaign as well that's actually run by United Way, but it doesn't look like it is. I'll think about that. I'll tell you what it is. Anyway, one of the things that you find on the form is that you can donate your $10 a month. You can earmark that for any charity you want. So if you're going to do $10 a month,
you can earmark that for the Boy Scouts. And I was entering all of this data in one day, and I asked them, well, how does this exactly work? You know, I was talking to one of the executives, believe it or not, he was standing right at my desk. I said, how exactly does this work? Does this money just get added on top of whatever you were going to give to the Boy Scouts? He's like, no. The way they do it is however much you earmark to the Boy Scouts, they deduct that from whatever the Boy Scouts were going to get anyway. So only if more money gets earmarked for the Boy Scouts than they had planned to give them do they actually get more money. And Planned Parenthood uses the exact same technique. That means they've got that much more money that's freed up to use for abortions. If you earmark your money for, the government earmarks their money for mammograms that they don't actually do, that they actually just refer people out for.
They just transfer some, move the funds around.
Yeah.
All
exactly.
Right. Well,
yeah, United Way is the biggest scam. Let me just say real quick, Jamie, years ago, I worked in marketing for Washington Mutual Bank. I was based out of South Florida. They don't exist anymore, but they were headquartered in Seattle, and they loved United Way. Of course, they also loved La Raza, but that's a whole other story. I used to dread, because part of my job every year was the quote-unquote United Way giving campaign, and I used to talk with so many branch managers who would say to me, you know, I'm a Christian. I give through my church, and these employees who didn't make a tremendous amount of money anyway, even as branch managers, were like literally forced to sign up for payroll deduction, even if they had a moral problem with United Way. And I'll tell you, it was part of my job, so it's like I had to manage this program. I hated that every year when that would come around. And I overheard my boss, who was she was very liberal. I have to say she was a good boss. But one day I overheard her talking to her boss about how selfish these people are. And it was all I could do, like, not to – I mean, I had to, like – I had to walk out of the room so I didn't do something that could end up losing me my job, because I was so angry at her for that statement. Typical liberal.
I saw that
happen. Other people's money.
Yeah, it's a very –
I saw that happen, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know –
intense pressure.
Yes. I think anybody who's worked in the corporate world, especially, you know, say 20 years ago, it was very familiar with that.
Yeah.
But interestingly, that leads us into our next segment.
Welcome to this week's edition of Moral Morons.
Very nice echo chamber there.
I had to really dig deep to get that kind of reverb in my house. Now I'm humming. Dear God. Igor, stop this. Okay.
Is he eating the electricity again?
He's a terrible. All right. So I'm just switching things off at random here. But now we'll get back to this week's moral moron. This honor, there are so many deserving candidates, but this one ran across my desk right before the show, and I just had to bring it up. And as a huge surprise to everyone, it came out of Hollywood. Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem denounce Israeli genocide in an open letter. This was from the Hollywood Reporter. And I'll just read you the money paragraph, which is basically the dozens of Spanish film stars led by, you know, all these Oscar winners, Penelope Cruz, Javier Bardem, Pedro Almodovar, there's my Nebraska coming out again, have denounced Israel's incursion into Gaza. And, you know, they call it genocide, yada, yada, yada. Now, I wanted to give this guy the benefit of the doubt. You know, he seems like a smart guy. Good actor, and we all have to acknowledge that Google isn't God, even though sometimes it feels like it. But I did Google Javier. I think. Let me see. I've got my search term right here. Javier Bardem denounce Hamas attacks. That seemed like a fairly specific sort of search term. And I didn't go through all 27,500 results, but the first 10 pages or so basically linked us back to Javier Bardem denounced Israel for Gaza incursion. And so these people, Javier and Penelope, were married, so I'll give it to them jointly. They get my Moral Moron of the Week award because suddenly they're concerned about civilian deaths. And yet they appear not to have issued a statement to the papers about the deaths of Israeli civilians for years at the hands of Hamas, Hezbollah, and the other boys' clubs that are operating out of Gaza and under, speaking of money going sideways, under the Palestinian Authority's government. So for me, I can't think of people more deserving of the Moral Morons Award than these two, because the Israelis have suffered persistent missile attacks from Gaza. They've suffered sneak attacks. There have been people blown up in buses. And just before this last incursion, the fine freedom fighters from Gaza snuck into Israel, kidnapped three teenagers, and murdered them. And yet, this didn't bestir Javier and the rest of the Spanish film community to protest. And for that, they are this week's Moral Morons.
I think there's one more thing that they really need to think about. The people who snuck into Israel and kidnapped those three Israelis and killed them, they used tunnels. Those tunnels were built by Palestinian child labor working for the Palestinians. And 750 of them, I think, died doing that. I thought that was nice, too.
It was. And, we could talk a lot about all the billions of dollars of aid from the world, not just America, but from the world, that have gone to the Palestinian Authority. And how curious it is that Yasser Arafat died a multimillionaire, yet the Gaza area particularly is a sewer. And one might ask, if one had any intellectual curiosity or, nay, intellectual honesty, what happened to those billions of dollars? And why is that area still a sewer?
Right. And one might also ask why it is that the Israelis actually take care of people who are injured, Gazan Palestinians who are injured in this conflict, and give them medical care, and actually warn civilians repeatedly to get out of a particular area that Palestinians have turned into a war zone, to eliminate as many civilian casualties as possible. So I guess that's escaped the attention of these idiots also.
Yes, and I imagine it will continue to escape their attention for years to come.
I think what escapes most people's attention is that they're actors, and they work for a living reading from a script. They don't necessarily have to have thoughts of their own. They just have to parrot the thoughts that somebody else gives them.
Bingo.
Wow. And that takes us right back to President Obama. But that's another show.
He doesn't even have to memorize his words.
That's true. He's like a wino at the bus station if he doesn't have a teleprompter.
Oh.
All right. So in keeping in with our theme of progressivism, let's take a look at another one of the more fruitful branches of the progressive weed, feminism.
Yeah.
This is near and dear to Scary Smart's heart, and that was actually one of the reasons I really wanted to have the lovely and talented and very moral Ms. Daria Ann DiGiovanni. Because I wanted to hear her thoughts on feminism as well. But as Scary Smart said it to me when we were discussing today's show, she said, feminism versus feminism, which I thought of as being a Jell-O fight in Las Vegas, but it was not. So.
That's because you always go to the bad place.
A boy can dream, can he? So...
We encourage it.
God love you. Let's sort of the first question I'll ask, since I am the Prince of White Bread, what is feminism? Scary Smart.
How about what did feminism used to be?
What did feminism used to be, Scary Smart? I can take direction.
That's a good trait in a man. Okay, anyway,
That was my inner liberal feminist coming out. Feminism at one time was all about getting women real equal rights under the law, you know, just ensuring that they could own property, that they weren't considered the property of a guy, that they had an equal right to their children if something happened to the marriage, that if they had children out of wedlock, that the father would be required to assist in caring for them, things like that, you know, really basic stuff. What it has morphed into is the right to be taken care of by anybody you want, which there's a real problem with that. When Betty Friedan wrote The Feminist Mystique, or The Feminine Mystique, back in the 1960s, it was groundbreaking. It was earth-shattering. She pointed out that Victorians had put women up on pedestals. And pedestals are great if you want to be worshipped, but it's really hard to get down off of the pedestal. You know, you are this figure. You are this box, and this is the box that you will remain in. And that's a problem. She pointed out that in the 1950s, something similar had happened to women. That a lot of women had been put in this box of wife and mother and the Donna Reed sort of person. So her argument in second wave feminism was that women needed to come down off the pedestal, which is great, except they haven't come down off the pedestal, have they? Because
or have they changed?
On special treatment.
So they've changed the pedestals.
Yeah, they've just moved to a further one down. Oh, okay, so you're going to take care of all these things first? Well, now we want this.
Okay. So that's how you see feminism today?
Yeah, they've just put women back up on the pedestal. Feminism has put women back up on the pedestal that Friedan insisted we needed to get off of.
Okay, I'll have to think about that. My experience of feminism was just mostly... I had cognitive dissonance around feminism because I was raised sort of the idea that, you know, people are just people and, you know, that all those sexist, racist, conservative ideas that what you do matters more than what you look like in the world. And, you know, in this case, what your plumbing might happen to be or your chromosome mix. So when I didn't encounter the new progressive feminism, that would be under my second wife, known affectionately as E2, the evil-tongued ex-wife. That was actually part of my wake-up around the decay of progressivism and modern liberalism, the basic, double standard. I called it the doubly standard procedure. You know, racism and sexism were bad, yet it was perfectly acceptable to talk about not liking to see fat white women, you know, things like that. And then, you know, hearing, for instance, that all men, that was a very common term. I think it was actually one word. I just imagined a space there. But all men do X. All men want a younger woman, you know. All men are potential rapists and that sort of thing. And at a certain point, you go, gosh, that really sounds, I don't know, prejudicial, like a biased, generalized statement about a group of people. And you know, and of course, this didn't really go over well in the E2 world to hear. I would play
E2 now.
You know, it could be part of it. You know, but that's another therapy session. And it was very fun to play the what if game. Because at a certain point, you get kind of tired of being told you're, you know, racist when you're actually a reverend. You know, apparently there's no difference, you know, in that mindset. To play the what-if game is like, oh, okay, so all men want younger women. Well, you know, so let's just imagine I was in a social setting and I happen to say all black men are thieves, you know, and... It would be like a scene out of Scanners. Her head would explode and, you know, that sort of thing. But but anyway, I digress. So.
That should get away.
But it did certainly. It was part of my wake-up, and that's why I tend to scoff when I hear women like Sandra Fluke saying they're feminists and they're strong and they're, you know, they're strong, but they're so oppressed at the same time. It's hard to contain my mirth when I hear that. Daria, what are your thoughts on feminism today? And in fact, Daria, do you consider yourself a feminist?
Not by the way the word, not by the meaning it has taken on today. No, I mean, I consider myself a constitutionalist and believe that, you know, we all have God-given rights, men and women, and certainly as American citizens under our system of government. Griff, I was raised in a similar type of household where, you know, I'm the youngest of five. I have one sister and three older brothers. So I grew up, you know, my brothers were awesome. I loved hanging around with them. And, you know, I was always taught that, you know, I was going to, if I wanted to go to college, that was for me. If I was going to have a career. I mean, nobody ever said, oh, you're a girl, so you're not going to do these things. So I was never raised with that. And I want to point out that one of the biggest fallacies that drives me insane with so-called modern feminism is that women didn't hold any kind of meaningful jobs until they came along in the 60s. Well, my Aunt Emma was an entrepreneur back in her day in the 40s, and she owned a very successful beauty salon that people would come all around. She was a hairdresser. She was a business owner. My cousin Millie was the first female graduate of Temple Pharmacy School in Philadelphia and was a very successful pharmacist. And these women also, by the way, maintained their moral standards as well. Imagine that. They were able to be successful in business and still retain their morality and their traditions. Amazing. And I just really think, sadly, and Griff, you didn't just allude to it. You basically, you made the point very clearly, that it's become an all-out assault on manhood. I mean, look at Pajama Boy. Pajama Boy is the standard now that liberals hold for what an American male should be. I mean, that should tell us all we need to know. I mean, these people want to deny biology. They want to deny, like, I love Stacey McCain. I don't know if you guys read his blog, but he does a lot of commentary and research on this topic. Okay, Jamie, so he's great, isn't he? I read his blog like every day. And I mean, and I encourage everyone, theothermccain.com, because it's phenomenal. But, you know, and he's constantly talking about the stuff like the PIV, that penis and vagina is always rape. Well, no. You know, I mean, you know, God created men and women to be different for a reason. And, you know, there's nothing intrinsically evil about that. It's what people do with that. And so it's just, I can't stand it. I do not identify with these women, and I actually hold them responsible for destroying the contemporary dating scene and any semblance of morality and tradition and courtship that used to go on in this country.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. Well, so, you know, I enjoyed it a lot. In the wrong kinds of ways. When feminists were attacking Sarah Palin, because one looks at Sarah Palin and you look at her resume, which was far superior to Barack Obama's, for instance, she is a feminist in the old style, a feminist success story. All the things, many of the things for which she was given a lot of crap by feminists, would be lauded as long as there was a D behind her name. I mean, she went to like five different schools to get her degree because she had to keep working while she was doing it. And, you know, but she entered beauty contests, and that was a whole feminist thing earlier in the 70s where it turns out that for a long time, beauty contests were the leading source of scholarships for young women.
Yep.
So there was Sarah Palin doing what she had to do to get a scholarship. She worked away. She took on the machine, all that sort of thing. You know, she fought. She spoke truth to power. She stuck it to the man. She fought the entrenched interest. She became governor because she wanted to make things better. And yet, she was derided as an inauthentic woman by feminists and all these sorts of things. And I found it really personally repulsive at the lack of principle. And I got to say, that's one of the things. You talk about things that drive you crazy, Daria. One of the things that drives the Prince of Whitebeard crazy is the lack of principle.
Yep.
You know, if you're against racism, then you're against all racism. It isn't just there are certain groups that are okay to exhibit their racism, black rappers. Racism is bad. It's same with sexism. Sexism is bad. If we're going to celebrate women's accomplishment, celebrate women's accomplishment. But because she was an evil Republican, and she was an uppity conservative feminist, actually, she had to be destroyed. And few things have angered me more in the political sphere in the last few years. Well, actually, Obama's done a lot. But at the time, I thought it was one of the most despicable things I had seen in a long, long time.
Let me point something out here. Today's version of the beauty contest that helps a woman get through college is the stripper pole. It's okay to work your way through college on the stripper pole, but it's not okay to go into a beauty contest. Have
so
you noticed
true.
That?
You know, as much attention as I pay to strippers, I miss that somehow.
You didn't see the right strippers, hon. You have to go to a better part of town.
I've been told that a lot. okay.
That's why she's scary smart. She brings up all of these points. Excellent points.
Well, I'm afraid to talk to her most of the time.
I'm safe. I don't bat much.
Well, so Sarah Palin, so that leads me to the question of why aren't conservatives considered real feminists?
Isn't that a good question?
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Daria?
Well, I think in the case of Sarah Palin, I think for a lot of feminists, her unpardonable sin, as much as they talk about quote-unquote choice, let's face it, the only choice they're interested in is abortion. When she got pregnant unexpectedly with her fifth child, and I believe she was away in New Orleans at a conference when she found out, could have very easily have taken care of the, in their mind, problem. And then after she found out that her unborn child would be born with Down syndrome, she committed another unpardonable sin and gave birth to a handicapped child who in their minds is a lesser human being or the child of a lesser god or however you want to put it. And I believe that for many of them, they can, especially the ultra-rich ones, you know, like the Upper East Side crowd, you know, in New York, or, you know, the elite feminists, they cannot honestly look themselves in the mirror and say that they would have made that same decision to have that child if they had been in the same position. I think she puts them to shame. And the second thing is, a lot of it is just good old-fashioned jealousy because she's one damn hot woman. She's beautiful inside and out. So they can't deal with that either.
One other point about the whole she should have had an abortion instead of having a baby. One other unpardonable sin she made is she didn't say, I went ahead and had the baby because religion. She actually sat and she thought about it. There was a point at which she was thinking that maybe that's what she should do because this was just in the middle of everything. But she made the choice consciously to go ahead and have the baby. And that's even worse.
Yep. Mm.
Okay. Yeah. And on the other hand,
go ahead.
I'm sorry,
Sarah. No, you go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
Someone has to do it. Conservative feminists, in what I've seen of conservative feminists, because there are conservative feminists and I'm one of them, they're all about motherhood. They're about embracing the difference between men and women. There's one critical difference between a dude and a chick, and that is the fact that women have babies. And feminism, traditional feminism, as if you want to call it that, you know, liberal feminism, has completely devalued the role of the mother. You know, you're supposed to park the kid in a daycare while you go get a job and let the state raise the child, basically. The only thing you're good for is the fact that you're a womb that can spit out new liberals.
Mm-hmm.
That's my experience. And, you know, you see them out protesting, and they run around, they protest like vaginas. They're dressed as vaginas. Like that's all that there is to a woman?
Yeah.
And as a man, I've heard I'm terrible for, you know, being visual and perhaps occasionally having the objectifying thought about a woman. And you're right. They're like externalizing that. They either don't understand irony or they're just completely clueless. But that's
If you ask a liberal feminist what they will do for mothers, they'll say, oh, we'll get you free daycare. We'll ensure that you can have an abortion if you want to have an abortion. And that's about it.
Yeah.
Conservative feminists don't want that. Conservative feminists want you to go ahead and have a baby, stay home with the baby if you can, get married, and, you know, be a mom. Give that opportunity to actually be a mom and bond with your kids. That's the big difference I see.
Yeah.
Interesting,
that's another thing that shows they're not really for choice, because they belittle women who do make the choice, if they can, to stay home.
Mm-hmm. Like me.
Right, and also, when you put it that way, it's the difference between you know, the family is being the foundation of the society, and the government being the foundation of the society.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because if your kid's being raised by state-run daycare and all that sort of thing, you're right. You're depending on the government, and you're making the government the source of security and support and you know, nutrition. When in fact, and then that's who you're going to turn to.
And if that's the way you're looking at motherhood, why bother to have a kid? That's why birth rates are down in Europe, because women look at it and they're like, okay, I can have a kid, and all it's going to do is interfere with my life. That's it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to have the joy of raising that child. I'm not going to be able to stay home and bond with it and love it and have it love me. I've got to stick it in a daycare and go back to work. Why bother? Have a dog instead. So that's what
sure.
they do.
Yeah.
So conservatives are outbreeding liberals now, which is great.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we can go back to that some more. But we're almost out of time, and I'm sure there's a lot of things that have come up that folks might want to discuss. So make some notes. Anything leap to your mind that we haven't really touched on or we need to beat into submission a little more, Ms. DiGiovanni?
No, I think we've all done a fine job. What do you guys think?
Oh, there's always more to talk about.
Of course.
Yeah.
So we will. In 5 minutes. Yeah.
What's that?
We did well
sorry,
within,
Dara,
the within our time
okay.
constraints. I think we did very well. So.
All right. Well, I think we'll get back to it. We'll get back to it next week, but I just want to give you a tease of something new that we will be trying to squeeze in next week. But with all these brilliant minds, it's hard to get everything in.
It's time for another fable from the big book of comforting fairy tales for delicate liberals. Read for you.
Okay. We'll do that next week, because after all this upsetting talk, it's time for something a little more soothing to the soul. But we'll just leave you upset this week, because that's all the time we have.
So we're not going to talk about Uncle Prince?
Uncle Prince has to wait. But I believe next week we're going to have a lovely photo of Uncle Prince reading from the big book of comforting fairy tales for delicate liberals. And I know we all look forward to that.
Yes.
All right. Well, Darianne, one last, we've got 2 minutes. I want to hear a plug from you. Give us the name of your book, please.
Water Signs, A Story of Love and Renewal. It's at Amazon.com on Kindle and in paperback.
And I've just started reading it. I'm into about chapter 5, I think. So I'll let you know, I think. I'm enjoying it so far, even though I'm not a girl, thank God.
It is a chick book, poor Griff.
Yeah. I did feel, a hot flash or two reading it, but I got over that. And Scary Smart, a plug for you, ma'am.
Today's story, The Enforcement of Happiness, up on LibertyIslandMag.com.
Yeah, it's a fun story. I read it, and I recommend you check it out. Go to see our friends at LibertyIslandMag.com. They do have a crowdfunding button as they're trying to get the next phase of the new counterculture off the ground.
Stay there and read more than just my story, too. There are a lot of really good stories in there that are wonderful stories for conservatives and libertarians to read.
And they're actually just good stories. And that's I think, the most important part, is they're good stories. If you get a chance, go over to Tacky Magazine on the web. That's T-A-K-I Magazine. They do have a story about Liberty Island and also about an author we know named Roy M. Griffiths. That was a nice thing to read,
that?
I thought. Yeah.
Look,
we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. Thanks once again to our guest, Darianne DiGiovanni, and we will be back next week with more mirth, more mockery, and more wit. That last part I can't promise, but we'll be back.
We're out of time for today's Riot. You can find us on the web at rightwingriot.com. No hyphen, all one word, Right Wing Riot. Thanks to our generous internet radio host, Daria Ann DiGiovanni.